And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. Well, it turns out that climate change is a complex, subtle, long duration kind of phenomena with a lot of nuances. And the information can be quite challenging for people to accept, to kind of come to terms with. And so over the years, the topic of climate communication has been a big one. I mean, how do you best communicate the reality of climate change to an audience that probably doesn't really want to hear it, right? How do you talk about it? For many, many years, there was this hope among climate types like myself that the proverbial weather person, in quotation mark, the person you see on TV telling you about the weather would somehow include climate as part of the evolution of the weather that they're talking about. Well, it turns out over the last few years that I think has begun to change. We'll find out. There's more and more of an acceptance where, we will soon find out what the right term is. The weather person who talks to you on the TV that they can talk about climate change, and we're thrilled to have an actual expert, someone who actually does it. We are being joined by Chris Groninger, who you may know if you're in the Boston area, was on Channel 10, NBC 10 here in Boston, a meteorologist here for several years, did a lot of discussion of climate, has put up reports about climate. Recently, he has taken a new job at KCCI in Des Moines, Iowa, where he's still talking about climate. So we're thrilled to have him with us to sort of... Well, there's a lot of interesting questions, but Chris, welcome. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Ted. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That's great. So, I mean, just before we go too far, do you think that the, shall we say, the atmosphere among weather people has changed on TV, the TV broadcasting? Is it more possible to talk about climate nowadays?
I think it certainly is. When you have something that is so obvious and that all of the data points to it. It's not a fictional character that you believe in. It's science, and it is science that we have hundreds of thousands of years of data through ice cores, ocean sediment, thousands of years of tree rings that can give us the chemical breakdown of what the atmosphere was like that long ago. We know how CO2 reacts in the atmosphere and what it does to the temperature. So I think that's one of the key ingredients in being able to tell an effective climate story. But we're also seeing a lot more degreed meteorologists in these roles. For decades, it was a personality, a weather presenter. The majority of the people that you see on TV are degreed atmospheric scientists, meteorologists, another name for that. Mm-hmm. And many of us have studied climate science as well. And we've been connecting the dots for several years. I think it was within the last 16, 17, 18 years that it was taboo to talk about, to now where a lot of meteorologists are starting to incorporate it into their day-to-day weather casts.
Interesting. The professionalization of the degreed people who are actually on TV talking about it. It's hard to not talk about it, I suppose, when you know so I guess that's the question that I want to present to you is, being a professional degreed meteorologist who knows the science, who is in a position to talk to lots of people during this crazy year. I mean, I think we've gone from the Texas freeze out to fires out west, all that kind of stuff. What's it like to be in the position you're in? And I guess the first one question I have is, what position do you see yourself as being in? Do you see yourself, of course, you're a person on TV providing information. Are you an educator? Are you trying to change minds? Are you just like the guy from Dragnet, just the facts, right? I mean, how do you see your job as a weather person as it relates to the climate aspect of things?
I'm on the broadcast board or the American Meteorological Society, which is headquartered in Boston. It's our professional organization, and they've led a campaign in years to be the station scientist. Our colleagues are tremendous, but they don't have a background in science, many people in the newsroom. And we've had to learn things on astronomy, seismology, geology, everything in between to be that scientific mind. So it was only natural for us to talk about something else that's in atmospheric science, which is climate change. I think that that's not just what a lot of us do, but I think it's a job responsibility as a TV meteorologist that makes the connections, that connects the dots between weather events and climate change. What I think derails the issue are people who may not have the education or the scientific background that connect dots inappropriately. Instead of going from A to B, they go from A to C. And that hurts the message that we're trying to portray. What I'd like to see is a lot of these environmental journalist positions be filled with people who are degreed scientists as well, because it's not making as big of a leap if you have that background in the science to understand how it's connected. I think that's where we really need to look at and work towards to effectively communicate the risks associated with climate change.
That is a good point. I mean, that as you are more comfortable with the information, you're able to address it more clearly. So what I hear you saying, though, is that you are presenting the facts. I mean, here in New England, you've done it, but I mean, the person on TV is always explaining how the Bermuda High and what's coming in from here in the jet stream. So it seems natural to be able to include this sort of climate information to say, yeah, this is just the bedrock of the things that have to happen, right? So tell me, do you, in your job, I'm sure that being a, what's the right, you're a meteorologist, you're a broadcast meteorologist, is that the fair term? So you're on tap on a regular basis when you're in the office to be on camera. Are you producing climate related snippets between times on camera? I mean, how do you manage that? How do you make sure that you don't like go too far or say the wrong thing or do something funny? I mean, how does that work?
When I worked in Boston, I started the country's first weekly series on climate change. And that required 7-day work weeks. And the burnout was significant. And in this new role as chief meteorologist, I can help develop others to help make them storytellers. I incorporated into my newscast. And what I'm proud of when I did it in Boston, and I'm doing it now in Des Moines, outside of those special segments, I crunch numbers. Again, with the scientific background, I know how to piece everything together to look at how climatological averages, for example, have changed here in Des Moines from 1878 to 2021. We have a large data set here. Boston has a large data set, and you can do the number crunching yourself and show some amazing trends and uncover some clear climate connections. I think that there are a lot of meteorologists that do that. And I really think that that's something that they need to do. It's a little extra added work, but I think it's something that comes with the job. When you can get weather on an app, on a 24-hour weather network, you need to find ways to be original. And I think climate work is one of those ways to be original, to tell that story as part of your weathercast, where a viewer may not have gotten on their app or by turning on a 24-hour weather channel.
It's interesting you use, there being this, two things there. One, the interesting you use the word storyteller, right? Because it is, I mean, storytelling is a human thing, right? It's like to understand how things are playing out. But I guess the other question is, I think it's great, you're doing original, looking at the data in an original way, relevant to the local where you're broadcasting to. in order to make something that is of interest. So is there a particular thing you picked up that probably hasn't been echoed all the way back to Massachusetts yet that's about Des Moines, Iowa, that is of interest?
Sure. Our 90-degree days, what's interesting is what we're seeing with being a large agricultural area. It's more difficult to warm up in atmosphere that has a lot of moisture in it. We're not seeing the huge dramatic swings that other parts of the country are seeing. The Arctic and the Antarctic regions are warming at the fastest pace anywhere in the world. But what I did find, which was interesting just by number crunching, that maybe the summer wasn't a huge number of degrees above average. But what we've seen since the late 1800s is that the 90-degree days have shifted from the average last 90-degree day of September 3rd to now around September 10th and 11th. Really? That's a one-week shift over time, and that's a concern. It might not jump out at you as, okay, we saw a record number of 100-degree days over the course of the season, but if you look at the long-term trends, it still shows the same thing. And in Boston, I did number crunching for Boston Harbor and the tidal gauge there to show that we have seen 2 to 3 times the number of flood events, meaning when that tidal gauge goes above flood stage, we've seen a dramatic increase since 1970, which was the halfway point of when that gauge was put in Boston Harbor. Uh-huh. And that is directly correlated to rising sea level. That's the only way you can attribute that increase. Of course, we've always had storms, strong storms in New England. The fact that we're seeing these high tide floods without a storm is what's concerning, and that's what's driving those numbers upward.
Interesting. So tell me, the in your role, so you're a meteorologist in a particular town, given the fact that Texas was freezing and California's burning up, does that come into your discussion of the local the local conditions, or do you avoid not avoid it, but I mean, it's not conducive to getting your message? Let me back up one step beyond that. I mean, it's like you're not trying to convince anyone. You're just trying to connect the dots for the weather in the locality that you're in. And say, yeah, there are antecedents there. There are climate relations here. So, is it true that you would then not talk so much about like fires in California?
No, I think no. That's actually a great example of what I was just going to give for an example. I used as a graphic coming out of a national story on the fires, segueing into weather. I told my anchors that I was going to do some stats on the wildland fires in California. Quickly did the math in the top 10 to show how many acres the top 10 fires have burned in California history, and that the vast majority of those have happened since 2000. That's an easy way to dovetail a national story into local coverage before you segue into your forecast. So I do make those connections if it's not going to derail the forecast, which again is my primary job. That
right,
makes sense.
Right. Do you find any, shall we say, sympathy or lack of sympathy in the audience? You must be conscious that, of course, there, we all know it's like highly politically charged territory, right? And so you, I mean, probably even when you were here, even here in Massachusetts, there is pushback, right? We're not immune to it as well. Do you find yourself, how do you manage that? Let me put it that way.
No. There is a lot of pushback, but you have to make the decision. Are you going to let that get in the way of an important story that's worth covering as a journalist, as a meteorologist? And you can't let the negative pushback. I get horrible emails, really? But I do get positive emails. And what's interesting is when I was in Massachusetts, the climate activist group, I think, were very out of touch when it comes to what was going on in the media. Ted, you were one of the rare exceptions. When it came to other groups, many didn't even know we were doing a weekly climate change series and that we were the first in the country to do so. And the focus has been on the lack of coverage.
Right.
But just as important is building up the coverage that exists and making sure that they have a support base, the meteorologist that's covering it, that is coming up with those stories. Because if not, then those stories will go away. Because it, again, it's a very viewer-driven industry. And I know you on our next segment, you were mentioning about talking a little bit more about that. But I think you kind of need to focus on that and see where they're is room for improvement for people who are climate activists. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there are negative emails, but here the climate activists are very supportive of our work in doing this, receiving many emails. And I'd say the positive emails outweigh the negative here, which was very different in Boston, where we pretty much exclusively get negative emails
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff. Well, Chris, this is a topic that we could discuss for a long time, but I think that we need to respect your time, respect our listeners' time. We'll put it down here. I want to let me say what I will do is we'll put up links to some of the stuff we've talked about at the blog. It'll be at massclimateaction.org/blog. Chris, what's your Twitter handle so that all the activists listening to the show can jump on that Twitter handle and support good meteorological reporting? What is it?
And I'll give you all suggestions to follow as well, because there are a lot of us doing it, and we need to build up those voices. So it's simple. It's just my name, at Chris, Chris Gloninger, Gloninger. Love to have you.
super. Okay. And if you have any questions about this podcast or want to make suggestions of different topics, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we should be talking about. Of course, you're listening to this show on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or one of those crazy modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask all of your friends to listen to us on their favorite modern podcast distribution app on their smartphone. We want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects local communities in order to safeguard our collective future. So, Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to be here.
Ted, I'm very happy to be here anytime.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.